were on this pathway to democratizing philanthropy a bit more when there are, you know, over a 500,000 donor advised fund accounts, you know, in the US, and that's growing.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Welcome. Today's guest is Brad Liebove, CEO of Earthshare, a donor advised fund focused on getting more funding into the environmental space. In this discussion, Brad offers his candid insights about donor advised funds, the fastest growing sector of philanthropy, and key improvements that we both believe need to take place in the industry. We also talk about Brad's work at One Earth, another terrific nonprofit working to address the climate crisis. Especially if you work in the philanthropic space, or maybe have a donor advised fund yourself, this conversation is for you. It was recorded at New York Climate Week 2023. Let's dive right in with Brad Liebove. We're here with Brad Liebove, CEO of Earthshare. Thanks, Brad, for being here.
Thank you, Matthew. It's a pleasure to be here.
How's Climate Week?
It's been a very inspiring week. It's amazing to see the sheer amount of people that have come into town to participate in well over 500 events. And I think one of the things that I've been very impressed with is the level of content and the level of intergenerational activity. I have been at meetings where I've seen youth activists and those that have been around the block, so to speak, that have participated in some of the very first convenings and are true leaders in the climate movement.
Nice. And is there anything different about the tone or the mood to you versus other climate convenings and gatherings you've been to?
That's a great question. I would say that there's a sense of optimism, but also a sense of, you know, urgency. I think that there is a considerable concern that we're not moving at the speed and scale to meet the climate challenges that we're all facing. For many of my contacts, we've all faced and experienced climate emergencies this past summer, whether it's been wildfire smoke in New York City, or flooding, or droughts, or excessive heat. The emergency is here, and it's real. And there's a ton of concern by really everyone who's here.
Yeah, and you've been in this space for some time. Can you talk about what is Earthshare and what are you trying to accomplish?
Earthshare has been an organization that has been active for over 30 years in the environmental movement. We work to inspire individuals, businesses, and employees to really step up and get involved in the environmental sector. We primarily operate a donor advised fund and create and offer tools within a variety of workplaces to inspire and educate and ultimately encourage people to donate their time and resources to the environmental sector.
Gotcha. So it's a donor advised fund, but with a particular focus on the environmental space and maybe a strength or an area of emphasis around workplace giving?
Absolutely. Earthshare as an organization was started by other environmental nonprofits in the late 1980s, in part because organizations like United Way and other charities were active in workplace giving environments, really advocating for social service organizations and other human service type of charities. We felt that the environmental sector is woefully underfunded and needs to be represented within workplaces across the country. So after over 30 years of activity, Earthshare successfully mobilized over $400 million in support of the environmental sector. And we do that by providing education and inspiration within the workplace, but we also serve as an intermediary where we process those donations, we vet environmental nonprofits, and ultimately re-grant those funds in the form of general operating support.
Got it. So a company comes to you and signs up. Can you take us through kind of the high level workflow of how it works, how do employees engage, how are grants recommended and so forth?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think oftentimes within a workplace environment, those C-suite leaders and other sustainability professionals, they're highly attuned to what the needs are of employees. Research shows that employees are far more engaged and likely to stay with a company that engages in giving. And environmental giving being one of the top areas of interest by employees, especially younger generations coming into the workplace. So we'll often receive a phone call and be invited into the workplace to participate in a employee giving campaign. Now, decades ago, typically how this worked was that a company would typically engage in an annual giving campaign. It would often be in November or December to coincide with the holidays. And groups like EarthShare would be responsible for identifying environmental nonprofits that we would pre-vet to ensure that they are in good standing, that they are engaged in environmental work, often within the same location that the business is located, but then typically with a national or international footprint. We would then prepare educational material and really work on a one-on-one basis with that workplace to ultimately provide the information that employees needed in order to make an informed decision. What was unique about the work that we do, and especially within the context of donor advised funding, within a workplace giving environment, when an employee makes a donation, we, upon receipt of that donation, we turn around and re-grant those dollars nearly immediately. So we often think of payouts within philanthropy. Our payouts were 100% within 12 months of receiving receipt of funds. So EarthShare, in moving hundreds of millions of dollars to the environmental sector, it really became a very valuable source of support for environmental nonprofits of all sizes, because these are funds that are unrestricted, and they're directly supporting the general operations of really some of the leading nonprofits operating today.
Right. So donor advised funds, one of the core value propositions in many respects is that the duration of from when you make the gift to the donor advised fund to when you grant it out has a lot of optionality around time. Someone sells a business, they give the money to their donor advised fund, and then over many years decide to grant it out. And so your actual payout of grants out of the amount of money in the total donor advised fund account may be a much smaller percentage. And what would be like an industry average for a typical DAF payout rate?
Yeah, typically in the industry, we're seeing less than 5% payout rates. There is no stipulated requirement to pay out those funds. Now, we recognize that the intent for most donors is to ultimately engage in grant making, but our research that we are tracking certainly shows that most DAF accounts are not actively managed.
Right.
You know, deposits are made, they're left sitting on the sidelines. And those are funds that are intended ultimately for charity. And so today there's well over $250 billion being warehoused in donor advised fund accounts. And so we as an environmental organization, you know, we certainly find that objectionable. So it's important for us that when we engage in donor advised funding, we require, we mandate at least 10% annual payouts for all of our account holders.
Right, right. Okay, so I mean, these are really important facts, and I was very excited about this conversation because I know you can, you know, speak them plainly. So we have the fastest growing sector of philanthropy is donor advised funds. Maybe you can help us understand a bit of the history or why it's such a big deal. And then we can really go into more of those stunning statistics about how much is sitting ungranted and where is that money sitting. But first, you know, paint us a picture of the development of the DAF landscape.
Yeah, the deaf landscape started in the 1930s, and it really wasn't until the late 1980s, early 1990s, when the wealth management firms that that certainly recognized the growing need and opportunity to advise their clients in opening up charitable giving accounts or donor advised funding accounts. And so the amount has grown over 500% just since the 2000s in terms of dollars under management with the major commercially sponsored donor advised funding organizations that are affiliated with the banking industry. So we've just seen an overall explosion. Mm-hmm. Now, whether that relates to just overall wealth growth in the country, or whether it is a greater interest in philanthropic giving, I think remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that dollars are sitting on the sidelines. And when it comes to environmental giving, we have an even greater challenge. You know, environmental giving in this country is only makes up roughly 3 to 4% of the total. And those are most estimates that have been generated over the last several years. And it's remained remarkably steady. Mm-hmm. With donor advised funding, it's also the same. It's only 4 to 5% of all donor advised funds are ultimately granted to support environmental causes. And that right. is a significant challenge.
Right. So if I have $100 and I give it to my donor advised fund, and then I give $5 per year on average into the nonprofit ecosystem, that represents the 5% payout. The 4% that goes to environmental causes is of that $5. Yeah. So we're talking about 20 cents of my $100 actually getting into the environment. And that's a problem, right? And that is indicative of the overall philanthropic sector statistics. Globally, many different studies correlating these numbers. And, you know, many studies indicate it's more like 2%. It depends on how you treat, you know, things like animal rights in those calculations. But yeah, I mean, any sane person saying that, you know, the Earth's hottest years on record in the midst of a widely recognized ecological crisis and climate emergency to put 20 cents of every $100 of philanthropic capital, you know, when obviously philanthropic capital is still just a tiny portion of our overall economic, you know, GDP and total financial value that persists in the system, mostly headed in the wrong direction. It's it's really stunning and stark state of affairs.
Yeah, the banking system isn't going to save the planet. Let's look at Fidelity, you know, as an example. Fidelity Charitable, which is affiliated with Fidelity, the financial services company, is the largest donor advised fund sponsor in the U.S. They warehouse over $48 billion in assets, and they earned over $112 million in fees. The information that they provide to their donor advised fund account holders is insufficient to inspire the level of giving that the environmental sector is needed. Mm-hmm. Now, there are many arguments to say that, you know, these DAF providers that are affiliated with the banking industry are not incentivized to see that grants are paid out because they're earning significant fees from the assets that they have under management. Mm-hmm. And our argument is that we want to see more wealth holders, whether they be small wealth holders that have a donor advised funding account with $100 in it, or larger ones, to really move to mission aligned organizations that are not affiliated with the banking industry. We have the tools to inspire ultimately provide that level of support that any donor needs in order to identify the issues that they care about, the organizations that are making a difference, and we will work to create a custom giving program in order to move dollars to the frontline solutions mm-hmm. that are ultimately going to save this planet.
So, yeah, I mean, there's so many good intentions here, right? Mm-hmm. And so many good people working in all of these organizations. I myself am a donor advised client to several DAFs, including those that are more for-profit oriented. And I've found that the DAF model is tremendously helpful so that there doesn't need to be creation of our own foundation structures that require an enormous amount of overhead for legal and, you know, accounting expenses. That, you know, why would I do that when I can effectively pay the same or less in overhead, simplify, decrease liability, and just use a donor advised fund and then be able to disperse the funds to the nonprofits of our choice at the pace in which we're ready to move. And, you know, for us at a personal level, we had the sale of a company and we weren't ready to give it all away overnight. That would have been, you know, effectively irresponsible. We didn't know the best way to deploy the capital and we wanted to layer our time and our effort and our skills in the deployment to try to get as much return on investment in value created as possible. So I really empathize, and having interacted with account reps and leadership and folks inside these donor advised funds, I've never met anyone with bad intentions. But it does feel like there's some structural incentive misalignments. Mm-hmm. And one of those primary misalignments is what you described as the fee structure being based on assets under management. If the donor advised fund is incentivized to keep as much capital under management, then another way to say that is they're incented not to see the money go out the door to the organizations that are being supported. And even when the people working in those donor advised funds want to do good and see the money granted, like there's that incentive misalignment exists. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the incentive misalignment exists. And I think there's also a challenge in terms of the share amount of account holders and the expertise that it takes to really develop the type of content and the advisory support for a large segment of donors. Fidelity has over 300,000 account holders, many of which are not actively managed accounts with account balances of under $25,000. I think organizations, whether they have a disincentive to assist with providing advisory support or whether they just have not really figured out how to manage that challenge, remains to be seen. I think that organizations like Earthshare that are in the space, that have credibility, that have deep relationships with environmental nonprofits and deep relationships of working with donors for decades, I think we're a solution set that really needs to be considered. When we look at the environmental sector, we in philanthropy, we often think about the frontline organizations doing the great work and not enough time and attention is paid on those organizations that are really working to be intermediaries. It's not a sexy business, right? But if we're going to see greater amounts of philanthropic giving move more quickly, more efficiently, more effectively, we need to support organizations that are in the middle, that are really trying to build the tools and the communication and that support network to see that more dollars ultimately move to the organizations that are in need.
Yeah. And those middle organizations are tricky because I think we're up against two things. One is a traditional culture of thinking about nonprofits in the way we thought about aid, where we think we want 100% or as close to 100% of my dollars to go to that starving child on the other side of the planet. And I want as little overheads in the way as possible. And that's just not the right mental model or framework to think about equipping capacity for small, medium-sized nonprofits who are trying to do important work, whether it's influencing policy, whether it's, enrolling science, whether it's, you know, creating new financial instruments and so forth. So that's kind of one. But I think the second is it just requires a high degree of expertise and research and understanding. And, you know, most people, if they have $25,000 in their donor advised fund, they don't have time to talk to 15 executive directors and go to all of the different events and functions and read all of the PowerPoint slides and decks. And like, so we do need education and that type of handholding, or what you said, active account management. And we're not getting it from the Fidelity, the charitables of the world. What would you say to all of that?
Oh, completely agreed. I think that individuals, they often open up a donor advised fund account, again, because they have a compelling tax reason to do so, or they're being advised by their wealth manager, advisor. Mm-hmm. And then it often sits dormant, but for the occasional email that they'll receive or local community need that, mm-hmm. that crosses their desk. And they're like, well, I do have a giving account, and so I'll fund that donation from that giving account. Mm-hmm. I think on an individual level, we see, you know, a lot of people recognizing that they would like to get more involved. They would like better information. They would like to find opportunities to collaborate with peer donors. They would mm-hmm. like to find opportunities to attend events, to engage in learning. And we don't see that necessarily mm-hmm. happening with the large donor advised fund mm-hmm. sponsors. So we hope to see more sustained activity mm-hmm. to really encourage and inspire more people to ultimately establish accounts, but then also pledge and commit to doing the work that's necessary
right.
to see that those dollars move into the organizations that are engaged in important work.
When we have board meetings at Biome Trust, I've been referring to it as like, what's our threshold of yes? Because it's once you immerse yourself in the landscape, there's need everywhere.
Yeah.
There's no question that there's just thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of organizations that are in need of money. And so there has to be some sort of mental framework of like, you know, well, at what point do you feel convinced and persuaded that it's a yes? And what is the process in which you arrive at that? And obviously someone with a $20,000 donor advised fund account as an individual versus a family who's making giving decisions together versus a matching program inside of a workplace. Like, these are all different contexts mm-hmm. and we'll have different ways of arriving at those decisions. I'm curious, what are the catalysts that you see that seem to be most important or effective at getting people to a yes and moving the money and saying, oh, you know what, I believe in that organization. Is it emotionally, like something captivates them? Is it a relationship? Is it a social reference? Like, what are the mechanisms? And then how do we move more as a culture and as an environmental community towards accelerating that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think oftentimes local is a first point of contact for individuals. They often want to engage with organizations that are operating near and dear to their communities and the places in which they love. Mm. We often see that individuals in making charitable decisions will support organizations that they know that are more highly recognized. So, you know, it is no secret that the most well-known organizations typically outperform the organizations that are lesser well-known.
Right. Right. And it's a safe bet to give your money to WWF for Nature Conservancy versus someone that you haven't heard of.
Yes. And we've seen that take place in workplace giving. I think it's also important to note that organizations often listed alongside WWF, the Nature Conservancy, Earth Justice, Sierra Club, they gain additional credibility. So within our nonprofit network that we vet, we do work with the larger, more established organizations. We also work with smaller grassroots organizations. And what we have found and other research shows is when individuals are researching organizations and they see that the large established organizations have been vetted by EarthShare as well as smaller grassroots frontline organizations, individuals will then see a higher level of legitimacy and potential success with smaller organizations too. So ultimately, to really inspire individuals and families to step up to to give in greater amounts and greater frequency. Mm-hmm. Think education is first and foremost, creating opportunities for those organizations to ultimately communicate with those donors is really important as well. So mm-hmm. newsletter participation, social media following, reports, and other activity, those help to strengthen the organizational message and ultimately help to persuade donors to support those organizations. Within the donor-advised funding landscape, we do not see a lot of information being exchanged. We encourage our donors to be transparent with their giving, and we forward contact information along to our grant recipients so that they then could establish connections and direct relationships with those donors mm-hmm. to continue the information exchange.
One common criticism I hear of the nonprofit space is that there's too many silos. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've experienced that as well. And I think a fear that donors have is that the work is being duplicated or not effective enough because it's diluted across so many organizations doing the same thing. How does that lens inform you when you think about uplifting a grassroots smaller organization versus a more established, you know, regarded nonprofit?
Yeah, it's really challenging. I mean, the environmental sector is in my experience and observation, it's a difficult place. There are over 30,000 environmental nonprofits based on recent IRS reporting. And so many of these organizations are underfunded. So many of these organizations, fundraising is being led by an executive director who's also responsible for communication, also responsible for program delivery, for reporting to a board and facilitating governance. It's really challenging. And so organizations, I think, as a result, are very siloed. Mm-hmm. It's a very competitive environment. And there's significant administrative burden to be successful in a fundraising campaign. Many of the organizations that we work with, we are one of their first points of contact and hoping to receive unrestricted general operating support to at least supplement their budget so that they can continue to provide program services, but then also build a more sophisticated fundraising operation. For the larger organizations, certainly there are challenges to continue to sustain themselves and to ultimately support a pretty significant level of ambition and objective. But when we see greater amounts of professional staffing resource relationships that have really matured over years, we see a certain level of stability. Mm-hmm. I think that we see investment in a variety of different programs and tools that ultimately result in fundraising support.
Yeah. You've said the words general operating support a couple times. Why is that so important?
General operating support really covers the core of operations. It helps support your overhead, your management, your fundraising team, your facilities, your equipment, your telecommunications, your IT. So you name it. These are things that are just absolutely fundamental to supporting an organization. You know, oftentimes executive directors and newer organizations, they, in order to demonstrate their viability, they focus on program level or project level support. They have a great idea, they have a great program, very clear outcomes. Mm-hmm. And that represents really a smaller bet for a funder to support a very defined project with a defined outcome. It might be a bullseye in their mind. That's very much what a funder is interested in supporting. But typically that program level support is just enough to deliver the program, maybe a little bit more to cover some of the operating expenses associated with the program, but it's not enough to support the organization as a whole. And so general operating support is really the level of support that allows an organization to decide themselves how best to use those funds in order to meet their mission. Now, we've seen over the last handful of years, more foundations and donors supporting organizations and trusting that they will make the right decisions for their programming and allocate those funds across their different programs in order to meet their mission. And we want to see more of that.
Mm-hmm. So it's not only about supporting the core, the enabling infrastructure, but it's also an act of trust and a humble recognition that those who are doing the work are closest to the work and can make the right decisions about how to allocate those resources, rather than a distrust of like, oh, well, you're just going to pay yourself more salary, or you're going to waste it on fax machines and, mm-hmm. you know, business cards or whatever. It's like, you know, it is a different paradigm of philanthropy, which seems to be, you know, increasing with words like trust-based philanthropy and, you know, flow funding, where funders are recognizing, finding within themselves a degree of humility and trust and saying, okay, you in this local community, you in this particular domain of expertise have a proximity to the problem and to the solutions. And so we're going to trust you with the capital and not put a lot of restrictions or earmark, oh, you can only use the money for this and that and come back to us and do the accounting this way and that way. But to say, no, here's the capital, keep going. It seems that in that same breath, there's also a paradigm of how far into advance are we committing capital to organizations? Are we doing it just on a one-time basis, or are we doing it on a multi-year basis? Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. It's when I take a step back and I think about what's happening in philanthropy and the growth of donor advised fund accounts, which I think is a good thing. We're on this mm-hmm. Pathway to democratizing philanthropy a bit more. When there are, you know, over a 500,000 donor advised fund accounts, you know, in the U.S. and that's growing, I think that's a generally good thing. More people are stepping up and getting involved. Seeing activity of, you know, more private foundations really stepping into the environmental sector and making bigger bets, I think that's a great thing too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so $250 billion sitting in donor advised funds, 5X'd since the 2000s. We have this enabling infrastructure that has allowed people to not only have to create their own foundations, but to really take advantage of the tax deductibility, move their money into donor advised funds. There's a lot of different donor advised funds out there, like yourselves, but a huge amount of the capital is concentrated in a few. We've mentioned Fidelity is the industry leader. Where is that $250 billion sitting? Like where does it go? If it's donated to the donor advised funds, it's in nonprofit entity structures, like it's doing good, right?
Not necessarily. And this is one of the challenges within the industry. Typically, a donor advised fund is being sponsored by an underlying charitable nonprofit. That charitable nonprofit will have a set of investment policies that govern how those funds are being invested. Now, the donor advised fund industry, affiliated with the banking industry, certainly has an incentive to develop different investment portfolios that they design and that they control. And what we see is most donor advised funds typically offer anywhere from 8 to 12 investment portfolio options. They're designed by the wealth management teams at the related financial institution. And we don't think those funds are being used for good. We have been working with the Outdoor Policy Outfit to develop a number of estimates on what the potential carbon footprint is for those dollars under management by these investment firms. And we're estimating that it's close to 2 million cars on the road in terms of the likely carbon footprint of $250 billion, a portion of which is being invested in fossil fuels.
Mm. So the money is sitting inside of investment accounts oriented towards growth, designed by the wealth management departments inside the banks. And that's the default, you know, 8 to 12 options that the clients get. And those portfolio constructions are typically stocks and bonds.
Yes. So typically stocks and bonds we see a lot of, you know, index funds, various equities not always ESG aligned. Typically each of the investment houses, they'll have a small carve out and they'll refer to it as an ESG aligned investment portfolio or a sustainable investment portfolio. Not a lot of clarity on what the underlying assets are. What we find is most account holders just, you know, check a box and ultimately let funds sit. What we want to see is an alternative. Mm-hmm. So at Earthshare, we have an investment policy an organizational mission to only bank with financial institutions that align with our mission. So we hold our assets at a mission-aligned bank that is not engaged in any fossil fuel financing. We invest only in public equities and direct investments that align with our environmental mission as well.
Right. But even that gets scary because, you have small regional banks failing in the United States. I mean, you have Silicon Valley Bank mm-hmm. went under, and so you have a further incentive to play it safe and put your money at JP Morgan and just concentrate the assets into it, because there's such a fear of losing money in mm-hmm. our culture, right? Even if it's a donor advised fund and you're giving it away, like there's a sense of responsibility that you want to grow that number or at least preserve that number. Yeah. Maybe it's, you know, part of your duty is inheriting that money from a parent or passing it down to a child, and you want to maximize the good that you do. And so you want as many dollars to be in that grant making fund mm-hmm. as possible. But it seems like all of these behaviors are leading us towards this very unfortunate dynamic where $250 billion in stocks and bonds, tiny portion of that going out the door every year, tiny portion of that going into environmental causes. So what else can we do to really rectify the situation besides obviously moving funds to a group like yourselves?
Yeah, a couple of things. Well, first, let me just say that the risk of regional banks failing, sure, that exists. I'm yet to be aware of an individual that actually lost money on deposit. Mm-hmm. With our banking relationship, we bank with Amalgamated Bank, and we, you know, sweep all funds under deposit into FDIC insured products that we believe will not be used for any type of nefarious financing of industry that is wrecking our planet. Certainly have the ability to move, you know, additional funds into public markets and other type of products to provide that level of security. So I think mm-hmm. for most donors, the risk of having dollars lost in regional banks and in banking products is just, it's minimal and it can be, you know, appropriately mitigated. Mm-hmm. In terms of really working to, you know, scale and grow the movement, I mean, I often hear a quote, especially here at Climate Week, is, you know, everywhere, all together, all at once. We really need to take more risks with our grant making and with our charitable investments that we're making. Prior to releasing those dollars for grant making on a wider variety of solutions and a wider variety of organizations that are really working to address the environmental and biodiversity crisis that we're all facing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like we have a culture that understands compounding numbers and the importance of, like, well, if we can get X percent interest rate and grow it over time, then we'll have enough for retirement and savings. And you know, the Warren Buffett model of philanthropy that has been instilled in the culture of make as much money until the end of your life, then give it away, or maybe pass it on to the next generations. And yet from a scientific perspective, we know that the importance of decarbonization and dramatic climate action today compounds in value tomorrow. It's, you know, a ton of carbon sequestered today is not the same as in 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so value also compounds. non-financial value compounds, ecological health compounds. Like if we can restore and preserve ecosystem health, nature can actually help to heal and restore herself in ways that leaves humanity in a much better position 5 to 10 years down the road. And so the imperative is not to hoard and grow capital right now. The imperative is to move it into value creation in ecological and socially minded ways. Any comments on my little rants here?
Completely agreed. I mean, there are things that we could do right now which are not always comfortable. We often think about minimizing our own carbon footprint. We often think about reducing travel. We're doing those lifestyle adjustments to minimize our impact on, you know, inner communities and the planet that we live on. I think things such as decarbonizing your financial footprint, that makes a difference. Mm-hmm. We are financing, or since the Paris Climate Agreement, I believe a statistic that I saw is that we have still contributed over $5 trillion in financing for fossil fuel development around the world. That's killing people. So the individual steps that we can each make to ultimately move our assets to mission-aligned institutions, whether that be on the banking side or whether that be on the charitable giving side, that's low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we often talk about. It's not something that we think about. Earthshare and many other organizations really are trying to target the financial industry to say that, you know, we need better products. We need greener products. We want to see movement. And at the same time, there are alternatives out there. So I think it's not an either or, it's an and. There are individuals, there are businesses that their banking relationships, their charitable relationships, they're institutionalized. They are deep, they're longstanding, and it's not easy for them to move. And so we encourage, you know, those entities to push their financial institutions to hopefully develop the type of product and the care that's needed to support our planet. And then there are many others that I think are still thinking about how they can get involved, how they could step up. And we would encourage them to do what, you know, the appropriate research and to not think about this as a commodity. You know, oftentimes, and we've all seen this online, the analysis of fee basis, you know, for a variety of donor advised fund sponsors, the commodification of the relationship, you know, that exists, that's real. And that's not an excuse to charge high fees to say that a fee basis, you know, doesn't matter. But with that being said, what's 20 basis points when we're talking about mission alignment, when we're talking about organizations that are really trying to move the needle on issues and do that the difficult work of connecting and educating donors to the organizations and the people that are really making a difference?
Right. Yeah, makes perfect sense. One of my favorite nonprofits in New Zealand is the Gift Trust. We had a great interview with Cheryl Spain. The Gift Trust is a nonprofit itself, which, you know, shows where its ethic and incentives lie in some respect. And a large percentage of the capital that is going out the door from donor advised fund clients is going to environmental organizations. And in no small part, that's thanks to Cheryl Spain's leadership at how they organize events and giving circles and suggestions. And, you know, I mean, just last week I got an index summary of some of the local Wellington-based food nonprofits that are currently looking for funding and where they're at in their life cycle. And it was, you know, it's heavily curated, really good attention to detail. And yeah, unfortunately, you know, not that kind of experience with other, you know, donor advised funds, generally speaking. I don't want to play favorites or just pick on, you know, the big ones and say that, you know, all the small ones are better, whatever. I would also point, though, to, you know, groups like DAFI, who I think are trying to come up with a different incentive model of not charging as assets under management and trying to share a culture of giving through social features and functionality. And they're a bit more of a startup in this space, and many other great, you know, boutique efforts. So I guess, you know, it seems like there's a landscape of donor advised funds, and a piece of good news is that we can move money from one donor advised fund to another. Can you help us understand those mechanics? What's possible? And if someone wants to move funds from a DAF account to another, how do they go about it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So donor advised funds are by nature charitable organizations. Those funds are under the fiduciary management of that nonprofit. Any donor advised fund account holder could recommend a grant to another charitable organization. So if one is has an account sitting at Fidelity, for example, or any of the major DAF sponsors, they could log in, they can make a grant recommendation to any other DAF sponsor. Those funds will be shifted and ultimately a new account can be created. So it's fairly simple. I think to your point about receiving that curated list from the gift trust, it's a great tool. This is important work that's taking place. And we see a lot of different innovations, you know, in the space. Unfortunately, the challenge is building something at scale. So there are some DAF sponsors and organizations that will put together events, and those events will highlight three nonprofits, you know, in the environmental sector, and it's an opportunity for a meet and greet. It's a lot of time and expense that comes with really pulling together an in-person and sometimes virtual meetings. There are other DAF sponsors that will put together curated lists. There are other DAF sponsors that will create custom portfolios and funds. So they'll try to take the individual decision-making and due diligence out of your hands and into theirs. So we'll see DAF sponsors that might create a sustainable and regenerative agriculture fund, a climate justice fund, and they'll do the due diligence of identifying the organizations and the potential outcomes that would be included within the grant making for that fund. We see giving circles and other ways in which to allow for sort of this peer-based learning and grant recommendations as well. At the end of the day, I think we need to continue to experiment with all of those giving options. We need to flood the inboxes of account holders with opportunities to learn, to engage, and to engage beyond just charitable giving. The opportunity to attend events, the opportunity to volunteer, these are all things that are important. When we built our donor advised funding platform, one of the first decisions we made was to incorporate a module that allows for individuals to identify volunteer opportunities. We wanted individuals to ultimately be able to find multiple points of opportunity for engagement beyond just opening up their resources to a nonprofit.
Yeah. Everything, everywhere, all at once.
Yes.
Yeah. And without going too far into it, I mean, that's another one of those models that we're really excited about is this, you know, local bioregional lenses into things like matching pools, shared governance. You know, how do we bring that type of intelligence and decision-making power back into local communities' hands for the resources that they are stewarding? And like you said, you know, earlier in our conversation, it's often the local organizations that people have a pre-existing relationship with. And so, yeah, maybe we can also scale out in those ways. I do want to, just to cap off the donor advised fund, you know, critiques and discussions and pay respect to everyone that's in that space to honor the movement of hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, moving into the philanthropic sector as a result of the hard work that has been done. And now it's incumbent on the field to really get that money out the door and to pay attention to the ecological crisis. You know, that's been something that I've been trying to harp on for a number of years to the donor advised funds that we've interfaced with, is, you know, more environmental giving circles, more attention to the ecological crisis. You know, it's fairly inexcusable at this point that we're still steady at that 2-4% grant making dollars into the environmental space, given all of the overwhelming evidence and what we're seeing out in the world. Any closing thoughts before I ask you about some other topics?
I think that donor advised funding is an important tool. It's the fastest growing philanthropic tool And I think it has the potential to be a tool that really improves the lives of many around our planet working in the environmental sector. Mm-hmm. I think we have to develop the tools, the infrastructure to ultimately inspire and empower more individuals and families to deploy the resources that are sitting in DAF accounts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so you're doing all of this work for EarthShare, but I know you also are involved in other organizations in different capacities. One of those is also a favorite of mine, One Earth. Can you share more about One Earth?
One Earth is a fantastic organization that's really working to drive collective action to solve our planetary crisis of climate change and biodiversity loss. I became involved with One Earth in 2019 and joined the board, and have been working really closely with the organization to develop the knowledge, the scientific rationale for the solutions that we have today to solve our challenges, as well as the communication strategy to ultimately inspire and empower more people to take action and to support the pathway that One Earth has designed to meet our challenges. And One Earth, like similar to what we've discussed earlier with the challenges in philanthropy, it does work to inspire individual giving to support the solutions that One Earth has identified to save our planet. Mm-hmm. You mentioned bioregions. One Earth is a pioneer in developing bioregions across the world. They've long recognized that there are many areas on our planet that are dramatically more underfunded than other areas, and that the solution set for whether it's conversion of agriculture to regenerative, whether it is related to land and ocean protection, or whether it relates to renewable energy, we have significant needs. And if we start looking at the landscape of the planet within natural bioregions rather than political borders, it represents a fresh approach to driving resources and on-the-ground action.
Yeah. We had a great conversation with Justin Winters, executive director and founder of One Earth. And these three pillars of action around a just transition to 100% renewable energy, around the protection of land and oceans. You know, we have the Montreal Agreement 30 by 30 now, but we really need to get to half of the earth mm-hmm. and oceans. And then the shift to regenerative agriculture. And then underneath each of those three pillars, an array of distinct identified solutions and actions that can be taken. And, you know, what I really respect about One Earth is that there's a strong competency and connection in the scientific and research community. Clearly, a lot of good horsepower happening there. There's also a really finessed communication strategy. Yep. You know, Justin comes from a communications background. She had a lot of experience with the team at Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation. And so really good comms, design, aesthetic, you know, et cetera. And then also a real embrace of appropriate tools and technologies, mm-hmm. Including, you know, now big data analysis to help to identify, you know, where are there gaps in the funding landscape between those solutions and those array of solutions in the three-pillar framework, and where is the flow of funds actually going mm-hmm. from both the for-profit, nonprofit sector, private and philanthropic. And so, yeah, it's just a terrific organization. You've been involved for some time. And I think it's an example of one of those organizations that is surprisingly small amount of funding yeah. relative to what it's doing. Yeah. You know, literally drawing the maps of bioregions on the planet to help people understand and organize, literally helping to identify the financing gaps, shaping policy in high up, you know, conversations and circles, and yet a very modest budget, relatively speaking. Yeah, any other commentary?
Yeah, One Earth is one of these organizations that punches far above its weight. It's a really remarkable organization. And, you know, my interest originally was in the product, the in really spending, you know, an earlier part of my career in regenerative agriculture and nature-based solutions to climate change, I saw the One Earth team and the model that they put together to really make the argument that we were not going to achieve our Paris climate goals if we didn't dramatically invest in nature-based solutions to climate change, mm-hmm. and in particular, regenerative agriculture. And what I found was they were one of the first environmental foundations really leading with that message. Many of the environmental funders were too far removed from agricultural solutions to climate change. Yep. They were focused on our energy transition. They were focused in other ways in which to decarbonize. Very important. But One Earth, and through the work at the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation, were really leaders in putting that message out. Ultimately, as I became more involved and joined the board, it was really became clear to me the opportunity to build an organization. And so I've really enjoyed working with the board and with the staff to help this small but mighty organization incorporate, to build a governance team, to ultimately develop the programs and the tools to sustain itself, because I think it really carries a powerful message.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole team's done a great job. You have my support, love, kudos, endorsement, whatever, for whatever it's worth. And what else are you seeing, and how else do you place yourself in terms of supporting other nonprofits in the movement?
Yeah, it's my career has been largely focused in the nonprofit sector and really working to deploy both social and financial capital. What I mean by that is that within the philanthropic sector, we really have this unique ability to be brokers for change. At times, we provide that social license, that legitimacy to nonprofits and to leaders to ultimately be doing the work in which they are doing. And when we're able to also provide capital, it makes it possible. Too often, executive directors and young organizations are overburdened with fundraising. And I've often found myself teaming up with nonprofits really at the beginning of their evolution as organizations, and helping to take what is a concept, a strategy, and operationalizing that into an organizational roadmap that will allow for growth and scale. And I think without organizations, without individuals really providing sort of leadership, assistance, coaching, a peer network to executive directors and CEOs, and helping to really support what is often a startup environment in the nonprofit sector, we're not going to succeed and meet our goals. Too many organizations don't have professional governance. Too many organizations often have boards that consist of individual activists and others that are, you know, they're passionate for the mission, but they often lack the experience of building organizations in the nonprofit sector, which is what they're sitting in governance for. So I have really spent so many years sitting on boards of nonprofits, helping to ultimately grow those organizations.
Yeah, yeah. It's its own discipline. It's its own set of skills. And yeah, we absolutely need that capacity building at all levels. One final question for me, which is, you are an Edmund Hillary Fellowship Fellow, EHF in New Zealand. Any high level commentary on your experience with the country and with EHF?
EHF is a remarkable organization and program. I joined the fellowship, was accepted into the fellowship in 2020, just prior to the pandemic. I remember when I first read about the fellowship, and my first thought wasn't necessarily New Zealand. It was, these are my people. This is my tribe. Here are 400 individuals from around the world that are really focused on incubating solutions to global challenges. And that is something that I do personally and professionally as well. And so, you know, this sort of gets back to the earlier conversation around organizational building and supporting leaders of organizations. There are so many incredible people involved with EHF. The opportunity to then bring this collective knowledge and to think about it within the context of the of New Zealand, in particular with my area of influence and knowledge and philanthropy. When I look at New Zealand, I see some of the same challenges that we face in the United States. The environmental sector is underfunded. There's an opportunity for greater peer collaboration and learning. And organizations are under-resourced, especially those intermediary organizations that are really trying to grow the philanthropic sector within New Zealand. So I think there, for me, there was opportunity to bring lessons learned and networks and resources that I've built in the U.S. and to hopefully bring those over into New Zealand to assist with some really great work taking place. So the experience with the fellowship has been remarkable. I've met many new friends and colleagues, and it's also been very helpful in the work in which we're doing here in the U.S.
Yeah, well, I know the team and network is grateful for all of your contributions and your support. Are there any final messages that you'd like to share, or any other questions I didn't ask?
Well, I think that you've asked some really great questions. I think that the more that each of us individually and through our networks could do to support environmental work is critical. Time is running out. And most people are just absolutely astonished that such little amount of resources, 3-4% of philanthropy, is moving into the environmental sector. That's abysmal. The environmental issues that we're facing should be a number one concern. And so I would encourage people to get out of their comfort zone, to find organizations in which they could support, to learn about issues, to sign up for newsletters, follow social media of organizations like Earthshare, like One Earth, get involved and take a chance, especially if it's dollars that you're earmarking for charitable causes. I think you can make a world of difference if you step up and participate.
Brad, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Brad. To learn more about Earthshare, go to earthshare.org. And for more about One Earth, go to oneearth.org. You might also be interested in the conversation we had with Cheryl Spain from the Gift Trust. Links are in the show notes, and you can find all of our discussions at maearth.com. To support us, please like, share, subscribe, comment, all of the things that help boost us in the algorithm so that we can help elevate the regenerative economy movement. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on the next one. Thank you.